You're listening to The Truth Podcast from PursueGod.org.
Pull up a map of the world. Trace your finger over to the Middle East. Look for a tiny strip of land right on the eastern edge of the Mediterranean Sea. It's about the size of the state of New Jersey. It doesn't have any massive abundance of natural resources. It doesn't control any of the world's major oceans. And yet this tiny sliver of dirt and rock completely dominates our global news cycle. You could argue that it dictates foreign policy. It starts arguments at family dinners. And if you've grown up in the church, it probably shapes what you hear from the pulpit. Why? Why are we so fiercely divided over this specific piece of real estate? You've probably felt the tension. You turn on the evening news, you see rockets flying, borders shifting, protests erupting. You log onto social media and you see two of your Christian friends posting completely opposite takes. One is flying the flag of the modern state of Israel, quoting Genesis, talking about biblical prophecy. Maybe you've watched some of these YouTube channels that just are all about this kind of stuff. But maybe your other Christian friend is posting about human rights or advocating for Palestinian Christians and quoting the Sermon on the Mount. Now, both love Jesus, both read the same Bible, both believe they are looking at the situation clearly. So the question is, what's going on here? Well, today we're going to take a deep dive into an article on Pursue God titled, How Does Theology Impact My View of Israel Today? I'll put a link to it in the show notes below. But I want to make a bold claim right out of the gate. Here it is. Your view of the Middle East is not ultimately driven by Fox News or CNN or your political party. Your view of the Middle East is actually driven by your theology. Specifically, it's driven by an invisible pair of theological glasses that you wear every time you read your Bible. You might not even know the name of the prescription you're wearing, but today we're going to take those glasses off. We're going to hold them up to the light. We're going to figure out exactly how they color everything that you see. In fact, this is the first lesson of a 5-part article-based series at Pursue God called Israel and the Church. And I think it'd be great for your small group or maybe someone that you're mentoring if these are the kinds of things you're wrestling with. Now, first, let me just address the skeptic. I know what some of you are thinking. You're saying, hey, I don't wear theological glasses. I don't follow a system. I just open my Bible. I just read it literally. I don't need theology. I just need the text. And I know that's how a lot of people think. I'll admit it. I kind of feel like I think that way as well. It sounds super spiritual. It even sounds, to me, it sounds great. It sounds accurate. But the problem is it's actually impossible to do. Everyone has a theology. Everyone has an interpretive framework. When you read the phrase, the house of Israel in the New Testament, your brain instinctively decides if that means the physical descendants of Abraham or if that means the global church. You don't make that decision in a vacuum. You make it based on the patterns, on the teachings, and the traditions you've absorbed. You've probably even made some of these decisions without knowing it because of the church that you grew up in, or really because of the country that you grew up in. So in this series, and today we're just going to get a quick little primer on it, but throughout this series, we're going to look at two major frameworks that shape how Christians view Israel. One is called dispensationalism, and the other one is called covenant theology. We're going to look at the history, we're going to look at the Greek, we're going to look at some of the hard texts and the real world implications, because how you view Israel doesn't just dictate your politics, it dictates your mission, your view of the church, and how you understand the promises of God. So let's get into it. Now, to understand why we argue about Israel today, we have to rewind the clock. We need to look at the historical and linguistic context of these two massive theological camps. Let's start with covenant theology. Covenant theology isn't new. It's actually the dominant view of the Protestant Reformation. Yep, that's right, from the Martin Luther days, that kind of stuff, 500 plus years ago. If you go back to Calvin and Luther and the Puritans, this was the air that they breathed. The word covenant in the Greek New Testament is diatheke, and it means a binding agreement, a testament, a promise. Covenant theologians look at the Bible and they say, okay, this is one massive unified story from Genesis to Revelation. God has always had one single plan of redemption. He operates through covenants. There was the covenant of works in the Garden of Eden, which Adam broke. Then there was the covenant of grace, which runs through Noah and Abraham and Moses, David, and then ultimately finds its perfect final fulfillment in Jesus Christ. Now, in this view, the church in the New Testament isn't a new invention. It's the organic continuation of the faithful remnant from the Old Testament, the Jewish people from the Old Testament. So covenant theology people look at Galatians 3, where Paul writes that if you belong to Christ, you are Abraham's seed. And the Greek word for seed, which by the way is sperma, is singular. And so Christ is the ultimate seed, and anyone connected to him is part of the true Israel. So we're talking about Jewish people from the Old Testament or modern day Christians all around the world today. So that's a brief overview of covenant theology. We'll talk about this a little bit more later in the series. But for now, let's look at the other side, and it's called dispensationalism. So if covenant theology is a single storyline, dispensationalism is, let's say, it's more like a blueprint with a bunch of different rooms, right? So this framework became really popular in the 1800s through a British minister named John Nelson Darby, and then exploded in America in the early 20th century because of a reference Bible called the Scofield Reference Bible. If you've got a grandpa or grandma or a great-grandma or grandpa who grew up in the church, they probably have one of these. Now, the word dispensation comes from the Greek word, which means household management or administration. So dispensationalists argue that God has managed his relationship with humanity in distinct eras or dispensations. So we'll get into the details more in a subsequent lesson in this series. But for right now, you just need to know that the bedrock of dispensationalism is this idea. God has two distinct peoples with two distinct plans. He has a plan for the physical ethnic nation of Israel, and he has a separate plan for the church, which is made up of Jews and Gentiles. So dispensationalists believe that the promises God made to Abraham about the physical piece of land from Genesis 12, go back and read it for yourself, that those promises must still be fulfilled literally to the ethnic descendants of Abraham. So already you're probably starting to think now about some of those YouTube videos that are super popular about Israel and the promises that God made to Israel, and even about how all of those things connect into the end times and God using Israel at the end of all time. Let me try to illustrate the difference between these two theological thoughts. So covenant theology is more like a massive, think of it like a massive ancient oak tree. The roots are the Old Testament patriarchs. The trunk is Christ. The branches are the church, Jews and Gentiles alike. All of them pulling life from the exact same root system. It's just one tree. But think of dispensationalism more like a train track. You have two parallel rails running through history. One rail is Israel, the other rail is the church. Sometimes they run close together, but they never really merge into a single rail. God drives the train of history down both tracks. Now, for many years, this debate was just pretty much academic. You know, they fought about it in seminaries and in dusty theological journals. But then, in May of 1948, David Ben-Gurion declared the establishment of the modern state of Israel. This was a huge deal. This was a big deal in our lifetime. Jewish people, fresh from the unimaginable horrors of the Holocaust, actually got to return to their ancestral homeland. The flag with the Star of David was raised. Now, if you were a covenant theologian back then, you would have seen this as a massive geopolitical event. But if you were a dispensationalist, you would have seen this as a divine thunderclap. This was the super sign of the end times. Because for a dispensationalist, the prophetic clock, which had been paused for 2,000 years, just started ticking again. Again, more about eschatology and dispensationalism when we get to that specific lesson in this series. But for now, let's take a look at the first of our major lenses that we're talking about here, and it's called the prophetic lens. We're talking about the prophecies in the Old Testament and also sometimes in the New Testament and how to interpret those prophecies. Let's start with this question. How significant is the dirt in the Middle East, right? If you're wearing dispensational glasses, then that land is everything, because dispensationalism insists on a hyper-literal fulfillment of Old Testament promises. So the establishment of Israel in 1948 wasn't just a United Nations resolution. It was a direct fulfillment of some of the prophecies from the Old Testament. Look at Ezekiel and Isaiah. So for a dispensationalist, the physical borders of Israel, that land stretching from the river of Egypt to the Euphrates, that land still belongs to the descendants of Abraham by divine unbreakable right, right? So that's what a dispensationalist would say. God gave them the deed, and he has never revoked it. So 1948 was great. God is intervening once again to give them that land. But covenant theology reads the map differently. Covenant theologians tend to universalize the promises about land and really a lot of the promises to Abraham. So what does that mean? It means that they view the land of Canaan in the Old Testament as a type or a shadow. They look at Romans 4:13, which says that the promise to Abraham was that he would be heir of the world, not just a strip of land in the Middle East. So they look at Romans 4:13, they look at Hebrews 11, which says Abraham wasn't actually looking for a patch of dirt in Canaan. He was looking for a heavenly city whose architect and builder is God. And so in covenant theology, the physical soil in the Middle East doesn't hold divine prophetic weight today because Jesus has expanded the borders to include the entire renewed cosmos. The kingdom of God is here. That's how a covenant theologian would read the promises in the fulfillment of those prophetic promises to Abraham and to all the people of God through Jesus. Now, okay, a skeptic of covenant theology might raise their hand and say, hey, that sounds like replacement theology, which we've got some stuff on that in this series as well. But they would say, you're saying that God lied to the Jews, broke his covenant with them, and gave their blessings to the Gentile church. And this, by the way, is a really emotionally charged accusation. And by the way, historically, extreme versions of replacement theology have been used to justify horrific anti-Semitism. But a true covenant theologian will push back on that and they'll say, look, we aren't replacing Israel with the church. We're saying that the church is the continuation of true Israel, expanded to include the nations. R.C. Sproul said it like this: the church is a new Israel. The church has not replaced Israel, but the church is the fulfillment of Israel. So that's how a covenant theologian would view this. That's the prophetic lens. What about the people lens? Who exactly are the chosen people today? Now, if you follow the covenant model, you see one unified family. The chosen people are any Jew or Gentile who is spiritually united to Christ, period. That's it. You put your faith in Jesus, then you're part of the people of God. You're part of the chosen people of God. For dispensationalists, this is how they think of it. The Jewish people are still chosen in a distinct national sense, even if they're not Christians today. So they're still the Jewish nation today. Most dispensationalists would say this. They're still God's chosen people. And this is what fuels what is called Christian Zionism, where believers feel a spiritual biblical mandate to financially and politically bless the secular nation of Israel based on Genesis 12, verse 3. And this is how a lot of modern day Americans think about it, even instinctively, but especially those who have been influenced, maybe without their knowledge even, but they've been influenced by this dispensationalist perspective. And this is really what, in large part, has influenced a lot of American policy toward that region of the world today. Now, who's right about this, about the chosen people? What does the Apostle Paul say? Well, Paul wrestles with this exact tension in Romans 11. I encourage you to read that for yourself. And he agonizes over the fact that his ethnic brothers, the Jewish people, have largely rejected Jesus as the Messiah. And he asks the question, has God abandoned them? Listen to how he talks about it in Romans 11. He says, many of the people of Israel are now enemies of the good news, and this benefits you Gentiles, yet they are still the people he loves because he chose their ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, for God's gifts and his call can never be withdrawn. Now, this passage is kind of a real battleground passage for dispensationalists and covenant theologians, because we see two sides of the coin here. Paul says, in terms of the gospel, right now they are enemies, meaning that they're opposing the message of Jesus. And yet, he says in the next part of the verse, regarding election, they are beloved for the sake of the patriarchs. So God's call is irrevocable. So if you're a dispensationalist, you look at Romans 11:29 and you say, see, look, the calling on the ethnic nation of Israel is irrevocable. God is not finished with them as a distinct nation. He'll fulfill his specific national promises to them in the end times. John MacArthur said it like this. He's a dispensationalist, not like a super hardcore one, certainly not in every area of thought, but as it relates to Israel, he is. And he said this: God has a future for ethnic Israel. He made a covenant with Abraham, and he's going to keep that covenant. So that's how a dispensationalist would read some of those verses in Romans 11. But earlier in that same chapter, Paul uses a metaphor that covenant theologians lean heavily on. It's the metaphor of the olive tree. Paul describes God's covenant people as a cultivated olive tree. Because of unbelief, some of the natural branches, the ethnic Jews, were broken off, and wild olive branches, Gentiles, were grafted into the trunk among the remaining natural branches to share in the nourishing sap of the root. Now think about the process of grafting. You take a branch from a wild, messy tree, you cut a slit into a healthy rooted tree, and you bind them together. Over time, the vascular tissue of the two plants fuses, and they share the same water. They share the same nutrients. They become biologically inseparable. And so covenant theologians read this olive tree metaphor, and they say, look, it's one tree. Paul doesn't say God planted a second tree for the Gentiles. There's only one root system. So your theology impacts your view of God's chosen people, the chosen people of Israel. So if you only view Israel through a dispensational lens, you might find yourself defending the secular Jewish government today whenever you turn the news on. But if you view it through the covenant lens, then you realize that there's a massive population of Palestinian Christians and Arabs who are believers living in the Middle East right now. So a covenant theologian would say, wait, I feel more alignment with Palestinian Christians than I do with non-Christian Jews. Do you see the problem? Do you see how your theology influences the way you think about what's going on over there? Now, let's look at this through we're going to call it the missions lens. How does all of this impact your actual boots on the ground mission? Does theology change how we share the gospel as Christians? The answer is, well, yes, absolutely. If you hold a strictly dispensationalist view, you might see Jewish evangelism as a distinct, urgent, unique priority. Many dispensationalists are intensely focused on looking for geopolitical signs that the times of the Gentiles are wrapping up. They believe that we are waiting for a massive, dramatic, national turning point, whereas Romans says, all Israel will be saved. Ministry organizations that focus on bringing Jewish people back to the land of Israel or evangelizing them specifically to trigger end time events are driven by this kind of like hyper-dispensational theology. You could liken it to like hospital triage. If you believe one specific patient's recovery is the key to unlocking the cure for the rest of the hospital, then you're going to put all your best doctors in that one room on that one patient. And you're probably going to spend all your time watching those YouTube videos about Israel and the church from a dispensational point of view. But on the other hand, if you hold to covenant theology, then your approach to global missions is going to be more uniform. You don't have a triage room. You just have universal care. You're just trying to share the gospel with everyone. So in the covenant view, a secular Jewish person living in an apartment in Tel Aviv, a Japanese businessman in Tokyo, and a college student in Ohio all have the exact same spiritual standing. They're just lost outside of Jesus, and they just need to be grafted into the one olive tree of the church. You're just going to share the gospel with all of them the same. There's no special track for salvation. There's no plan B. There's only one new covenant in Jesus, which is available to everyone, everywhere, right now. The ground is entirely level at the foot of the cross. That's the missional view and how your theology shapes it. Now, let's look at one more lens, and we're just going to call this the political lens. And the truth is, American evangelicalism has been heavily influenced by dispensationalism over the last 100 years. And that's one of the reasons that we see so much support for the modern political state of Israel. It's kind of become a conservative litmus test in many ways. And the logic goes back to Genesis 12:3. God told Abraham, "I'll bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse." So a lot of Christians will take that verse, directly map it onto the secular democratic nation state of Israel, which was founded in 1948. And they'll say this, they'll read the Bible in one hand, they'll have their newspaper, if that's even a thing, open in the other hand. And they will say, if America stops sending military aid to Israel, then God is going to curse America. If your theology tells you that the modern state of Israel is literally operating under divine mandate, then you're going to justify almost any military or political action that they take. You'll view them not just like an ally, but as an untouchable instrument of God. That's what a lot of dispensationalists do to this day. But if you wear covenant theology glasses, you remember Jesus standing before Pilate saying, "My kingdom is not of this world." You recognize that the modern state of Israel is a secular nation. It's a government run by flawed humans. And so you hold them to the exact same standards of justice and human rights and international law as you would the United Kingdom or Brazil or the United States. You don't write them a blank moral check. You can absolutely support their right to exist and to thrive in the Middle East, but you do it on political, historical, and humanitarian grounds, not because you think God signed off on their military strategy. Now, we're going to get into the details of this a lot more in the upcoming episodes, but this was just an introduction to this idea that your theology definitely impacts your view of Israel today. So let's go back to the evening news that you're going to be watching tonight. The Middle East is burning. The pundits are yelling. Your Christian friends are all divided. What should you do? First, I want to encourage you to just recognize your lenses. Know that what you believe and why you believe it comes from somewhere. Maybe you know the terms now, even though you're not exactly sure which way you lean. Now, if you lean toward dispensationalism, make sure your zeal for prophecy doesn't override the command to love your enemies and seek justice for the marginalized. And if you lean toward covenant theology, make sure that you don't lean toward cold arrogance that forgets the Jewish roots of your faith. Ultimately, your theology shouldn't lead you, if you're a follower of Jesus, it shouldn't lead you to arrogant pride. It shouldn't lead any of us to nasty Twitter debates. It should lead all of us to our knees. Because whether we see the nation of Israel as a ticking prophetic clock or simply another deeply broken mission field, the goal for every single Christian should be exactly the same. We should all want to see men and women reconciled to God through Jesus Christ. We should be in the business of making heaven crowded. We follow a Jewish Messiah. And what did he do when he looked at the city of Jerusalem? Did he draft a military strategy? Did he pass out flags? Nope. Luke 19 tells us that as Jesus approached Jerusalem and he saw the city, here's what he did. He wept over it. He wept because the people in that city at that time didn't recognize the time of God's coming to them. He wept because they didn't know the things that make for peace. I think that that heart of agonizing compassion is the only valid Christian view of the Middle East today. The true peace of Jerusalem will never be brokered by the United Nations. It won't be won by a missile defense system. True peace for the Jew, for the Palestinian, for the Arab, for the Muslim, for the American, true peace is found in one person, the Prince of Peace, Jesus. Let's keep that in mind wherever we land on this important debate.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to share this episode with a friend. Find more resources to talk about these topics with your small group, family, or mentor on pursuegod.org.